I think the idea that he's going to his own hotel shouldn't be a shocker. It's a beautiful place. It's somewhere that he's very proud of. And I think it's symbolic of the kind of government that he's going to run on time, under budget, ahead of time and under budget. Same kind of theme that the vice president-elect expressed earlier, this transition, 20% under budget, $1.2 million returned to the Treasury. He's very proud. It's an absolutely stunning hotel. I encourage you to go there if you haven't been by. But I don't think the idea that President-elect Trump is having a reception at the Trump Hotel should be a shocker to anybody.
White House spokesman Sean Spicer urging reporters to check out the Trump Hotel in Washington. Well, today, a nearby wine bar filed suit charging unfair business practices. The suit claims the Trump Hotel is profiting unfairly from its namesake being president. And the suit actually cites that Spicer soundbite when he urges reporters to go there as an example. And China this week gave preliminary approval to 38 new trademarks for the Trump Organization, of which the president is still chairman. The trademarks cover all sorts of things, from hotels to golf clubs to escort services. The approval means the Trump Organization could be able to develop these businesses in China. Trump's global business empire is raising concerns over whether he is violating the Constitution's emoluments clause, which bars elected leaders from taking payments or other things of value from foreign governments unless Congress approves. Richard Painter was the White House ethics lawyer under former President George W. Bush. He's also vice chair of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and that's a nonprofit group of lawyers that aims to keep government accountable. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, so there's a lot to go over there. And first, though, I understand that your group has signed a letter asking the U.S. attorney in New York to investigate the president's foreign business deals. What specifically do you want him to look into?
What we're very concerned about is the payments from foreign governments and companies controlled by foreign governments. That would include banks and sovereign wealth funds. And there are other government-controlled entities that the Trump Organization is dealing with. And this includes, of course, foreign governments that pay for diplomats and others to stay in the Trump hotels. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. And we've asked the U.S. attorney up there in New York to look through the records and see what the president is getting that he cannot receive under the Constitution, and then try and work it out with him that he won't be taking these payments anymore. It's not constitutional. He's not allowed to do it.
Now, he has argued that because he's the president, he is exempt from any conflicts of interest.
Well, that's not true with respect to the emoluments clause of the Constitution. The Trump lawyers have not argued that the emoluments clause does not apply to the president. It clearly does. There is a separate provision, a criminal conflict of interest statute, that does not apply to any of the elected officials. But that's a separate issue, and that does not insulate the president from the constitutional issue of receipt of payments and other benefits from foreign governments, which is clearly unconstitutional.
Now, you are also part of a lawsuit which was filed back in January. Is this a similar complaint, or is it a separate?
Yeah, that's the same thing. I mean, we've asked a judge in New York, in the Southern District of New York, to do the same thing, ask the president or ask the Trump Organization what payments are being received from foreign governments and banks and sovereign wealth funds controlled by foreign governments, find out what this money is and figure out what's constitutional, what's not, tell the president what he can keep and what he can't keep.
So what do you make of this story about the trademarks that China has preliminarily approved?
Well, there are a lot of trademarks there that the president has received in a very short period of time. And that raises the question whether there is a special accommodation by the Chinese government. And if so, that would be unconstitutional under the emoluments clause, any type of special accommodation in connection with something like trademarks. That's what my concern is. There are a lot of trademarks there, and some of them are for businesses. I wonder why the president of the United States would have any interest in, for example, an escort service. That doesn't really seem to be very presidential.
Even though he hasn't profited yet because he hasn't exercised the trademarks, and he could conceivably wait till he's out of office to do that, right?
Well, yes, but these are trademarks of some value, or he wouldn't be trying to obtain them. These are for for-profit business. Of course, many of them are for business he's not yet entered into. I don't believe the president is currently in the escort service business, but he has a trademark for that. That is of some value.
So you've asked the U.S. attorney to investigate some of this, and, you know, his boss is Attorney General Jeff Sessions. What is the likelihood that the U.S. attorney in New York will go ahead and investigate?
Well, U.S. attorneys are usually quite independent of political considerations in their decisions about what to investigate and what not to investigate. So I would not expect the U.S. attorney to succumb to political pressure not to investigate this if he believed it was an appropriate thing for his office to be looking into.
Another issue we talked about in the introduction, it's not an emoluments case. It's a local D.C. case. This is the owners of this wine bar, the Cork Wine Bar, suing Trump and the hotel there, saying that the president owning the hotel means that's unfair competition. Lobbyists and other well-connected people go there and drink at the hotel bar rather than going to the Cork Wine Bar, for example. Do you think this lawsuit has merit?
I think it probably does. The concern here is that the lobbyists in Washington, certainly they have a lot of watering holes for their different events and the parties they throw and everything else. But all these different establishments that compete on an even playing field with respect to the atmosphere and the price and the service. But now we have a hotel that's owned by the President of the United States. And of course, everyone's going to want to run over there because if you have an event at the Trump Hotel, then the White House staff think it's really cool to go, and they go, and then the other executive branch officials show up. And so the Trump Hotel becomes a magnet for the lobbyists and the trade organizations and the others who all want to have their events there. And that's not good for the business of the other establishments in town. And so what you've got is a pay-to-play situation. That really is unfair competition for the people running the other establishments around town and provide just as good alcohol or services and ambiance and everything, but they just don't happen to be owned by the President of the United States.
Right, and if you have foreign dignitaries staying there, that might violate the Emoluments Clause too, correct?
Yes, and that would bring in an Emoluments Clause issue. So there is an Emoluments Clause component of this type of lawsuit. It can be much more far-reaching than just situations that would violate the Emoluments Clause.
So where does this all end up? There's a lawsuit. You mentioned also the complaint that you filed with Preetbhara at the U.S. Attorney in New York. But where does Congress fit in to all of this?
Well, where it ought to end up is the president ought to take the advice of the director of the Office of Government Ethics, who made it very clear the president really should sell off these business interests that create these conflicts of interest and either give it to his children, the ownership interest to his children, or sell the companies so that we don't have these conflicts of interest anymore. That's the appropriate solution to this. If the president doesn't want to do that, then I think Congress is going to have to start investigating what's going on here, figure out what foreign government money's coming in that would be unconstitutional, or what other potential conflicts of interest there are, and then make some recommendations to the president as to what he ought to do. And if the president refuses, then Congress is going to have to consider what further action is warranted.
And by further action, are you saying impeachment?
Well, if you have a situation where there's clearly a violation of the Constitution, at this point, we don't know what the facts are about the various business dealings of the Trump organization, where they're getting the financing, who their other investors are. Congress ought to get that information and figure out what to do.
That's Richard Painter, Vice Chair of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. He was the White House ethics lawyer under former President George W. Bush. Shock and disgust in the wake of revelations that Marines were sharing nude and degrading photos of female Marines on Facebook without their knowledge. More than 30,000 Marines are members of a Facebook group called Marines United, although not all of them are thought to have participated. The military is now investigating, and the head of the Marine Corps, General Robert Neller, says this.
When I hear allegations of Marines denigrating their fellow Marines, I don't think such behavior is that of true warriors or warfighters.
Well, joining us now is Kate Campbell. She's a former military police officer who left the Marine Corps as a corporal in 2012. Welcome to you, Kate.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And Gail Samak-Lemon is a journalist who has reported on women in the military. She's author of Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. Welcome back to the show, Gail.
Great to join you.
Kate, let's begin with you. Someone posted a photo of you while you were enlisted on a website called Just the Tip of the Spear. It was not a nude photo, though. Tell us about that. What happened?
Yes, it was a photo of myself on deployment in 2010, and it's pretty innocuous. I'm just leaning back. I have my Kevlar on, my flak, pardon me, on, and someone put their memes where people insert words onto the photo. So it said, I'm wearing a flak. I guess I think I'm a grunt now. But it wasn't so much the memes themselves that got me. It was when I started scrolling through the comments underneath them that I was blown away. I kind of went down a rabbit hole clicking on these guys who were commenting these awful things. Was I good looking enough to have sex with? Different rape oriented memes that they were posting underneath of it. That I wasn't a real Marine because I was a woman. And I started clicking on these names, and these guys were active duty. They were ranks above and below my own. I knew some of these guys, so it was just kind of a shock to me.
Yeah, I bet. So you and the other women that you knew had no idea that this was happening.
It was my first time seeing it. A friend actually tagged me in it. This was after I got back from deployment in 2011. A friend tagged me in it saying, look, you're this meme on this site. And that was my introduction into these kind of websites, Facebook pages. I previously really hadn't seen anything like that. So I don't know. I don't even know. I was one of the very few female Marines in my unit. So I don't know if I even commiserated with any others to ask them, have you seen this? Have you seen this?
So what was the general attitude by your fellow Marines, male Marines, when you were, you know, out in the battlefield? Did you encounter similar comments in, you know, person to person or in real life or any kind of harassment, discrimination, that kind of thing? Or was it mainly online?
In real life, it was rare. On my first deployment, I was on a female engagement team. So it was just myself and one other woman attached to an infantry unit. And depending on the group we were with that day, the unit we were with, there was a lot of hesitation there. I think, too, it was also a really stressful environment, and we hadn't trained with them. We were new. But there was never anything extremely direct. But what I encountered often was male Marines talking down about female Marines around me because the attitude was, well, you're cool. You're cool, Katie. But these other ones, blah, blah, blah. Like I was one of the boys, so they could talk like that in front of me, but it always made me think, well, then what are the guys who don't know me thinking when I walk by them? They look at me just the way you're looking at these other women around me.
And the important part of the military, and I think it's from what I understand, especially the Marines, is cohesion in your unit, that you should feel that you've got each other's backs.
Right.
Did you feel like they didn't have your back?
I felt the Marines in my unit were like my brothers, and they treated me like their sister. So within my small group, I felt like we had each other's backs and they had mine. But outside of that, no, I didn't feel that way, especially when I saw how widespread it was and how many of these sites there were. And even though I knew they had my back, they didn't have my sister's backs.
Mm-hmm. And Gail, you've done some reporting on this in the larger military. And does this surprise you?
Not really, and it's interesting. When I was working on Ashley's War, I spent, you know, 2 years in the special operations land, especially talking to women who had been on the front lines, like Kate, right, who were attached to special operations units, Army Rangers, Navy SEALs. And, you know, they were very quick to tell me that the men that they had worked with really did give them a shot because it was about the battle in front of them, because it was about the war and not about anything else. But when I launched Ashley's War and when we were out talking about this, I had a rule that was, you know, never read the comments. Because it was amazing to me how quick people were to be disrespectful to service members in uniform. I mean, imagine that. I don't understand where the outrage has been about the fact that it has been tolerable to disparage women in uniform simply because they're women. And what I found was exactly what Kate said, which is that the closer you were to serving with these women in uniform, the more respect you had for them. And I think a lot of the Rangers really had the backs of the women who served alongside them and became their champions when Ranger School actually opened. But, I mean, you know, just the general public, and not just the military public, by the way, civilians as well, felt very comfortable to say things online they would never have said in real life.
Mm. So Rangers, that's the Army. Do you think that there's a difference in the different services? The Marines, I understand, they have separate training for men and women. So is there a difference in how women are treated across the different services?
Well, I think the Army is much larger, right? And women make up 7% of the Marine Corps and, you know, more than double that in the Army. So I do think there is something to the numbers. But it's interesting. I was talking to Army women today, and they said, look, you know, I'm surprised people are surprised by this.
Hmm. Really?
You know, and that was really the reaction I got, even from folks who, you know, I know and love from Ashley's War.
So, Kate, did you ever report this to your higher-ups when you saw it? This harassment online?
Nope, I never said a word. I did confront a Lance Corporal in my unit who I saw on these pages who was writing terrible things about women, but I kept it in-house. I was a corporal then. He was my Lance Corporal, and I just pulled him aside and had a conversation with him about it, but I never took it anywhere else. And I never did speak up about it. Like we were saying, 7% of the Marine Corps are women. I know at one point in my unit, there was just myself and one other, and she was over in the canine unit, so I didn't see her very often at all. And you don't want to alienate yourself, because that's a very lonely existence. And they have it's called being a blue falcon, which stands for buddy F-word, basically a snitch. If you report these kinds of things, you're a blue falcon, and you are to be pushed aside, pretty much. So it's a way of shaming people who point these things out. And, I mean, I hate to say it, I didn't have the guts to do it then. Mm. I didn't speak up, and I wasn't quite sure what would happen. I'm sure I had such a wonderful command that they would have been receptive to it, but I don't know if even they would have known what to do about it.
Well, what happened when you told the Lance Corporal?
He stood at parade rest and didn't listen to me and probably was rolling his eyes internally, but he didn't post anything like that again, at least to my knowledge.
Yeah. And so, Gail, is that also a problem that women don't feel safe to tell their hires up, that there is not a channel, an acceptable channel where women could feel safe from retribution for airing these problems?
Well, I think there is an interest in, you know, in the Army in particular, but certainly, you know, also in the other branches to hear these grievances. But what do you do with them, right? Women have gotten so used to living with this low level of grievance, right, that isn't, you know, that falls well short of, you know, physical assault, which everybody knows to report, even though some still do not, for fear of retribution, right? But what do you do if somebody's just being really awful? If they continue to be awful, you know, if they were awful last month and are going to be awful, then, you know, the next month. And because it's become tolerated in society at large, right, and also inside the military, it's hard to know where you would go.
So then does it have to be, since women just make up 7% of the Marines, does it necessarily then fall on the shoulders of their fellow male Marines to say no, to speak up, to put a stop to this?
You know, I was at West Point and was asked this question, and the truth is, it's about leadership. You know, the military has tremendous leadership, and I do think it's about leadership setting the tone for what is okay and what is not. And I do think that is the center of what has to happen.
Kate, what do you think?
I think leadership's a huge part of it, and I do think it falls on both male and female. How I was saying, I didn't speak up before. I should have. I should have pointed it out. I wasn't quite sure how to do it, but I should have. But your peers, too, if they do consider you a sister in arms, they shouldn't put up with it, and they shouldn't let it stand. You said in the beginning 30,000 men were on this Marines United site, but not all of them actively participated. Well, how many of them spoke up and said, these racist posts, these sexist posts, these homophobic posts don't stand for what I stand for in the Marine Corps, and it's not okay? None of them. they were all bystanders to it, and they knew. You have to know that it's not right, you know?
Why did you leave the Marines?
I knew I was just a one enlistment gal. I wanted to finish college, and but I had always wanted to join the Marines. So,
Well, had you always intended to leave after just one enlistment, or did this kind of encourage you to seek another path?
I would have been open to staying. I went into it thinking I'm going to do this and then go to college afterwards, but I was always open to the idea of staying in, but I was definitely ready to get out by the time the end came. And this was, to be honest, this was a part of it. I loved the Marines. I loved the Marines I knew. But there was a sense that I didn't belong. And I hate to say it, I still feel that way walking into a veterans event sometimes or speaking up when I meet another veteran to say, oh, I'm a Marine too. There's this hesitation because there's this feeling that they're automatically... This was so pervasive in the culture to talk down on. They called us Wookiees, and we were WMs, Women Marines Walking Mattresses, that I almost wanted to be like, I'm a female Marine, but I wasn't a slut. You know, I almost feel defensive about it. It got into my head. It did.
Well, I want to thank you so much for speaking up today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having us.
Kate Campbell is a former military police officer. She left the Marine Corps as a corporal in 2012. Gail Smock-Lemon is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book Ashley's War, The Untold Story of a Team of Women Soldiers on the Special Ops Battlefield. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Great to join you. Thanks.
And if you are or have been in the military as a woman and you'd like to share your experiences or thoughts, please leave us a message at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Shani Jardin is here. She'll tell us whether or not we should be freaking out over the new WikiLeaks dump regarding the CIA and their ability to break into our phones and our television sets and listen in. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. It is Thursday. That means one thing and one thing only. Shani Jardin is here to talk. Web and tech news, editor of boingboing.net.
And for the moment...
Did you know you had a theme song now? That's it.
And for the moment, I'm not looking at my smartphone.
Well, that's a good thing.
Once a week.
Because others could be looking at it, too. Well, let's talk about that. The big story is the WikiLeaks release of those CIA documents.
Yeah.
Let's just listen to Sean Spicer, the White House spokesman, in his press briefing earlier today talking about that.
There's grave concern that the president has about the release of national security and classified information that threatens and undermines our nation's security. Obviously, he believes that the systems at the CIA are outdated and need to be updated.
Okay, is that the problem, that the systems are outdated and need to be updated? It seemed like the problem was the theft of the code or the information, I should say, that this was happening.
Well, one of the primary rules of computer and network security is that everything always needs to be updated, obviously. But Sean Spicer isn't the federal sysadmin. He's not the guy in the server room telling us when to update our devices. He's the one speaking for our president. That may be true. What we do know here is that thousands of relatively low classification CIA documents were released by WikiLeaks earlier this week. The method of the release, the way that the documents were released, is different than what the organization did early on. This was just, thousands and thousands of pages. Boom, there it is.
And we still don't know who gave the documents to WikiLeaks.
We don't. Some of the informed speculation that I've been watching includes even theories that there were a couple of different NSA contractors who were outed as being under investigation for the theft or the hoarding of classified documents. It's possible that one of these NSA cases may turn out to be linked to this. It's also possible that it was, I think the smart money is on the fact that it was a disgruntled contractor. Mm. Good to note that it wouldn't be the first time. That's basically what Edward Snowden
was. Maybe
a
relief that it wasn't Russia.
We don't know, but there's no reason. There's nothing in this that indicates that this, you know, like Vladimir Putin is to blame.
Okay.
I mean, perhaps in the grand scheme of things, but there's no signs pointing to Russia here.
But basically what we found out was that the CIA can break into our phones, into our televisions, into our messaging apps, and basically listen in on anything we're doing and saying.
Well, like, yes and no. So first, the CIA, it should be noted that their response to all of this was, first, we don't comment on anything, yada, yada, we're the CIA. But secondly, reminding us that the CIA, it is prohibited by law from spying on Americans. That's not,
right.
That's the whole point of the CIA, is not to spy on Americans. But the second thing is that this release does not show us that the CIA has capability to break the encryption on WhatsApp or Signal.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of botched reporting about this yesterday. So here are the things that this release does not prove to us. The CIA has not broken encryption on our phones. A lot of this stuff has to do with what you do when you got somebody's phone. You know, if you're in close enough business to get your hands on the phone, a number of the exploits that were described could be carried out. But this is not about like some kind of magical unicorn laser wave, you know, that I can point at your phone and read your Snapchat drafts.
So you'd actually have to physically have the phone.
Well, I haven't read through all of the thousands of the pages of documents, but honestly, this seems in some ways to be much ado about nothing. Everybody's running around with their hair on fire right now. And I just think like,
well, I think that one of the things that people were freaked out about was this idea that the smart TVs could listen in on you without your knowledge.
You know, read Boing Boing. We've been talking about this for 5 years. Cory Doctorow, my colleague who's also with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, he's been fighting against this stuff since he was out of the womb. Look, security experts have long been concerned about the fact that more and more devices are capable of listening to us, purportedly for good reasons, like to reorder toilet paper or you know, get a pizza. But they can also be used for bad purposes. I think, you know, I just want to go to church for a minute here.
Okay.
So both WikiLeaks and the CIA, you could say that both of these entities were created for specific purposes. You could argue that both of them were created for noble purposes. What happens when organizations are run by people who don't have the public's best interest at heart, right? The Office of the President, the CIA, the State Department, any of these institutions could be used to help or to harm. Are they in the public interest? Is what an institution or an organization doing in the public interest? When we hear spectacular claims, right, about something that's just, you know, you won't believe it. It's blows apart every precedent everywhere. Well, literally, like, there's dozens of stories like that every day, whether it's about the CIA documents or some new technology exploit or something that, you know, Trump tweeted when he was waking up at 3 a.m. I would just really urge everybody to pause, take a deep breath, and then read a few different technology mm-hmm. journalist takes on something
right.
like this before you decide that the CIA and Julian Assange are listening in on all your conversations.
Okay. There is a side benefit, a good benefit to these devices listening in on you. And that is a story that
yes.
you've come across.
Crazy.
A crazy story, but one that almost seems like it would be the plot of a spy novel or a murder mystery, I should say.
Yeah. Alexa, help me find the dead body.
Right? So there was a crime committed, a murder?
Yeah, a murder case. And law enforcement are looking to get their hands on the audio data that's available on an Amazon Echo that may point them to the killer in a murder.
Wow. So that Echo may have recorded
yeah.
evidence.
Yeah.
Unbeknownst to the killer.
Right. I mean, if you imagine if you have a listening device in your home at all times, it's going to catch the good things and the bad things that happen in your home. And I mean, look, if that was my relative who was killed, I'd be really interested in solving that mystery. And of course, the many thousands of us who have Amazon Echoes in our homes are also wondering who's listening in. And, you know, just going back to the CIA meme that's going around right now, the CIA zeitgeist on the internet, there was a video that we blogged on Boing Boing today. It's just a funny parody video, but where you ask the Amazon device, you know, tell me about the CIA, and it just goes silent. So everybody's paranoid, perhaps for good reasons, and perhaps for some reasons that aren't based in fact. Yeah.
But I could see privacy experts or advocates saying, ooh, hang on a second with this Amazon Echo story.
Yeah.
Even though, we want to solve the murder, but maybe they shouldn't be releasing this to to law enforcement.
Yeah. I mean, there are some very serious legal and ethical questions involved here. But going back to my rant earlier, I feel like part of the reason that I have faith that in the end Amazon's going to do the right thing is like Jeff Bezos is in charge. He runs the Washington Post right now. I feel like he's backing stuff that's basically good for America. And I just hope, I'm saying this because when they launch the drones, I'd like to not be spied on, but I do want to get all of my Amazon deliveries on time.
I think Jeff Bezos just heard you say that, so that's good.
Hopefully the CIA did too. I love the CIA.
Love Jeff Bezos.
Love Russia.
Love him.
Love Donald Trump.
Shani Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, and our regular web and tech commentator. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, the story of a family of refugees who escaped to America in the 1970s.
It was a minor miracle that we survived because we were in not a seaworthy vessel at all. It was not meant to go out to sea at all. So we're lucky we didn't all just drown at sea.
A graphic memoir about escaping Vietnam next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Artist T. Bui was born in Vietnam just 3 months before the fall of Saigon. That's when the South surrendered to communist forces in the North. Her family fled to Malaysia by boat and eventually made their way to America. They now live in Northern California. But she didn't remember much about her home country. She was just a little girl when she came here. So T decided to ask her mom and dad about their lives in Vietnam, how they survived not just the war, but life under the communists and before that, the French colonialists. And she discovered an incredible story. But she struggled with how to tell it until she taught herself how to draw comics. The result is a new graphic memoir. It's called The Best We Could Do. And T. Bui joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. That was a great summary.
Oh, okay. Well, you're welcome. And I'm happy to speak with you. I want to know exactly how you decided that this would be the best medium to tell your story and your parents' story, a graphic novel.
I tried to do it as an oral history for an academic, master's final project. So I have, hundreds of hours of tapes and transcriptions with my parents and my sisters. And I try to make it more inviting with photos and some graphic design. But it really wasn't something that, a regular person would ever want to read. So I think that's when I started looking around at other ways that I could tell it that would make the history accessible to people without dumbing it down and just make sure that the stories came across as real human stories. But turns out comics as a medium is really difficult. So it took me about a decade to get it right.
Wow. What's so difficult about it?
It seems like it's just words and pictures, but there's this whole other third thing that's happening with time and sequential panels, and you sort of infer what's happening in between panels.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to figure out.
So when you grew up here in America, and you came here when you were, 7 years old?
No, actually, I was only 3 years old.
Oh, you were 3 years old. So you came here when you were 3 years old to America. So obviously you don't remember anything really about Vietnam, right?
No, I have one or two flash memories that are set in Vietnam, and the rest are actually during the boat escape and the refugee camp, I guess, because those were the most standout things that had happened in my life up until that point.
And you remember the boat escape?
I just remember lying down in a dark boat with a lot of other people looking very seasick.
Yeah. And when you were growing up here, did your parents talk about their past and the journey?
When you talk about things in your family, they're always piecemeal and shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
So you grow up around this stuff and you think you know it until you actually try to write it down and you realize how much you don't know. So the book was an excuse to make sure that I got up as much of it as I could.
Well, why did you want to do that? Why did you think that their story needed to be told to other people?
I guess I had always been looking for a mirror in stories that I was told of my own experiences that I didn't really find it. Instead, I found a lot of very bad misrepresentations of what the Vietnamese experience was during the Vietnam War. Growing up, we always would like look forward to the next Vietnam War movie that came out, always hoping that like this would be the one that would be good, and it never happened.
Because it presented everything from the American perspective?
Yeah, so we were either, Vietnamese people were either the ones who got shot and you know, or never had any speaking parts, or maybe if they did have speaking parts, the actors weren't actually speaking Vietnamese. They were just speaking, sometimes I think, some made-up words. It felt very disrespectful.
I want to talk about each one of your parents and their particular upbringings and then how they met and got together. And let's begin with your dad, Nam. He was born during the World War II era and saw so many harrowing things growing up. It's a miracle he actually survived his childhood. Can you describe what his childhood was like?
Sure. So he was born to two parents who didn't have a lot of prospects because they didn't have a ton of money, but they were also in North Vietnam during the Japanese occupation of northern Indochina, it was called at the time. So there was fighting between Vietnamese insurgents and the Japanese army, and then also at the time the French were still around. There was just a lot of chaos and confusion, and people just tried to make a living any way that they could. And all this military presence and all of this fighting internationally, because it was during World War II, caused a huge famine in the north. So my father, when he was about 4 or 5 years old, was watching people around him die of hunger. And that famine caused a lot of having to move back and forth in his family so that they could survive. It was a real strain on their relationships and their family.
Yeah, so his dad leaves him. His mom is, I guess, disappears with a Chinese soldier, never to be seen again. And he's raised by his grandparents.
Right. And his grandparents don't like each other anymore at this point, but they stay together so that they can survive.
There's a really moving panel where your father is a teenager, maybe he's 17 or so, and he meets up with his father after many years. He's lived pretty well with his grandparents in the South. He's wearing these shoes, Western shoes, and he's facing his dad, who's wearing sandals because the dad is a communist. And it just said so much about the two different worlds in Vietnam.
Right. That was actually even before he moved to the South. So he was still living in the North, but he had been living in the city, which was protected by the French, who had come back to reclaim their colony in Indochina. And the people who were fighting against them were the nationalist communists or the Viet Minh. And my father's father had joined the Viet Minh to fight in the revolution and to have something to eat during that time of famine. They were separated for many, many years. And by the time they saw each other again, my father was no longer the little boy who had been left. He was a teenager with an education in a nice French school that his grandparents had provided for him. And he had different ideas and different opinions about what kind of life he'd like to live. And even though he had like principles and he knew that he wanted equality, and he actually was quite sympathetic to the communist revolution, when he came face to face with what life would be like, it seemed very dull and drab and actually not at all like the freedom that he imagined. So it was a turning point for him as an adolescent, just realizing that reality is not always the same as your ideals.
And worse, though, that the communists were actually rounding up people like his grandparents.
Right. The land reforms were happening at the time, and Vietnam was trying to copy the Maoist reforms in China, which didn't end well for anybody who was a landowner. So the complicated part was that my father's grandmother did belong to a land-owning family. That's how he survived the famine, was his family had access to food when others didn't. But that also meant that in a time of change, people who belonged to the land-owning class were just by default now enemies and in danger. So that's why he left the North in 1954 when Vietnam was split in two.
And then your mother had a very different upbringing. She had a very privileged upbringing. In fact, she learned how to speak French before she learned how to speak Vietnamese, right?
Right. So my mother belonged to an educated, well-to-do family. Her father worked as a civil engineer for the French. So this was still in colonial times. He had a nice job, which meant that his family was very well taken care of. They believed in a good education for their kids. My mother did really well in school, so she got to go to private French schools all her life. It wasn't until she became an adolescent and started reading books in Vietnamese, which she had to teach herself because they didn't teach that in the younger grades in French school. She started to read her own country's history and started to realize, wait a minute, not everything is as they've told me.
And so how did she and your father get together? They came from such different worlds.
They met in college. They decided to go to Teachers College in Saigon, which is now Ho Chi Minh City. But at the time in the early 60s, you know, my father was worried about the draft. All young men were getting drafted to fight in the war, which he didn't want to fight because he didn't necessarily believe in it. And my mother wanted to do something good for the country. She wanted to become a teacher.
Then the fall of Saigon, and they escape, and they, as we talked about earlier, they got on this boat, and it was a very harrowing journey, and finally ended up in Malaysia at a refugee camp. And then how difficult was it then to get to the United States?
Before they got to Malaysia, there were several failed attempts to escape. So this is over several years that the situation gets more and more desperate for them. It was illegal to leave. If you left and you were caught, you would all go to jail. By the time that we actually got on a boat, it was a minor miracle that we survived because we were in not a seaworthy vessel at all. It was meant to just be a river boat that carried like sugar cane up and down the river. It was not meant to go out to sea at all. So we're lucky we didn't all just drown at sea. Once we got to the camp, basically you get arrested by the local authorities and then you get taken to the refugee camp and eventually processed. And then you wait. The different countries that were accepting refugees at the time would send delegates every week and they would interview people who wanted to settle there. So there was like the big question of, well, where do we go? Who do we know? My mother assumed that they would go to France because they spoke the language, mm-hmm. but we didn't actually know anybody there. Well, she had two sisters who had been able to leave 3 years earlier who went to America. We decided to try that route. And luckily, because we had a relative in the U.S., they were able to do the paperwork for us. Like you actually have to have a financial sponsor in the U.S. who says that they'll take care of you if you can't get a job. Mm-hmm. So that's what my aunt in Indiana did for us. In the meantime, my mother had a baby in the refugee camp. I think she was maybe 8.5 months pregnant when we got on the boat. So by the time we landed, they took her right away to the hospital. And she was there for 3 days and didn't give birth. So she said, just send me back with my kids. I've got three other kids I have to take care of in the camp. And thank goodness she came back because we were all very hungry and scared. But then I think a few days after that, she went into labor and they were not able to get her back to the hospital because the camp was too far. So my uncle and another man and my dad made us a makeshift hammock and carried her in the dark to the midwife's house a couple of kilometers away. And she gave birth at the midwife's house.
Oh, my gosh. And that's your brother.
That's my little brother.
Your little brother, yeah. So there are four of you.
There are four of us now.
And it's interesting because you open your novel with you in labor in a hospital. And there couldn't be a more stark difference between what you just described and your experience. I mean, this took place in the 1970s. Your mom's giving birth to your brother. It wasn't a long, long time ago. And yet it could have been another century.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, it puts everything in perspective, right? So I didn't have a great labor, but all things considered, it was pretty cushy compared to what my mom went through on her last one. That was the way that I approached writing the book, was that I had been sitting on all of this material from my parents about their lives and the Vietnam War and all that. But I didn't feel like I had any right to tell their story until I actually made that transition and became a parent myself. And I realized, oh gosh, that it's such a big responsibility and how can you not mess up? So any feelings of resentment that I might have been hanging on to the way that a kid hangs on to stuff about their parents, like all of that went out the window and I was able to like just talk to them as people and try to figure out who they were as people before they became my parents.
Tee Bui, she's the author of a new illustrated memoir. It's called The Best We Could Do. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you want to see some of the comic panels from Tee Bui's book, you can go to our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. We have a link to our slideshow and a blog there. Coming up, all the rain has given us a lot of flowers. We're going to tell you where you can enjoy the super blooms next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Late winter showers bring forth March flowers, at least here in Southern California. We're on the precipice of a so-called super bloom, which is exactly what it sounds like, a super amount of blooms. Joining us to talk about where and when to check them out in the coming weeks is Casey Schreiner, founder and editor of Modern Hiker. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Good to see you again.
Thanks for coming in.
Of course.
We tore you away from the super blooms so you could come in here. So right now people are talking about going to the San Diego area to check out the Anza Borrego Desert.
Yes. Everyone and their mother has seen in their Facebook feed the photo of the purple flowers in the desert.
Yes.
Anza Borrego is predicting a super bloom, and everyone seems to be saying within the next week or so, it should be peak bloom. Right now, it's sort of focused around the Borrego Springs area. But the rangers down there are saying that it's going to be one of the rolling blooms. So even if you can't make it down right now, there's always going to be something blooming there within the next couple weeks. And actually, the Anza Borrego Foundation just kicked off their spring plant walk. There's free events that happen every Friday morning where if you don't know where to go and you've never been to the desert before, because Anza Borrego is a huge park with not a lot of infrastructure, the ranger will basically handhold you and take you to where the cool blooms are happening, tell you about the plants, and leave you with a little bit of knowledge as well.
And by the way, bring water. When you go,
yes,
there.
Definitely bring water. There are the town of Borrego Springs has some options. The visitor center has some options to get some water, but it is the desert and it is warm, so please bring water.
Mm-hmm. And you can camp there too.
You can camp. There are a couple developed campsites that are pretty full. I think I snagged the last site available last night, so I apologize to everyone. But you can also camp dispersed there. So if you have some backcountry experience and you follow the backcountry Leave No Trace ethics, you can camp for free almost anywhere in the park.
Oh, fantastic! So you can actually sleep amongst the blooms.
Yes, don't camp on the blooms.
No.
That would not be Leave No Trace ethics, but find a nice clear spot and you'll be good.
Well, that's another thing is we keep, as you say, we see them in our Facebook feeds. We're talking about them now. You know, is there any worry that the hordes of visitors will ruin the blooms?
There is. You should always remember that these plants exist for a reason that does not tie in specifically to your Facebook likes. So when you see blooms, use a telephoto lens. Don't go crawling through them. Don't, create your own trails to get up to them. A lot of the poppies especially grow on really steep and loose rocks. So it's actually kind of dangerous if you're crawling up around to try to get some good poppy shots on your macro lens. Just take them from a distance. You'll be fine. You'll still get likes, I promise.
Okay. And speaking of poppies, poppies, yes. Where can we see them?
So poppies are always the big thing. It's the state flower of California. They're beautiful orange. I think the orange against the blue California sky is probably the most beautiful thing you could see on the planet. Mm. So I'm a little biased, but Walker Canyon off the 15 right now has a beautiful bloom of poppies. We had some readers send us some Instagram shots earlier this week, and it's going crazy out there. I was also in Chino Hills State Park in the eastern part of the park yesterday in Bain Canyon, and there are huge swaths of poppies and lupins blooming on the side of hills, as well as elegant clarkias, and a few monkey flowers are starting to bloom as well.
What are monkey flowers?
Monkey flowers are like these big, they're kind of like droopy yellow or orange bright flowers. They usually bloom really strong right now and then they die back. So they look like they're dead for most of the year, but for in the spring they turn bright green, and they sort of like, they have these sort of like tendrils on the branches that sort of go off in all directions.
Wow. That sounds incredible.
They're really pretty.
Sounds
yeah.
Dr. Seussian almost. What about Joshua Tree?
So Joshua Tree, I was there last weekend, and it was pretty cold and cloudy. But during in the southern part of the park, a lot of the rangers are saying that there's some blooms happening there. Reliably near the Cottonwood Springs area, which is just south of the visitor center. It's the Cottonwood Springs Visitor Center. There's a couple nice trails that you can do there. There is the Mastodon Peak Trail, as well as the Lost Palms Oasis Trail. And if you don't want to do those, I think the Mastodon Peak is about a 3-mile round trip. Lost Palms Oasis is a little bit larger, but you can also just wander around Cottonwood Springs. There's a beautiful, pretty flat trail there. I was there around this time of year last year, and the blooms were insane. Beautiful beaver tail cactuses with those like giant neon pink and purple flowers.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely stunning.
Yeah. Okay. And so what if we want to be a lot closer to home? What would you recommend?
So you don't have to travel too far. The good thing is these blooms do last for the next couple months in general. So if you're not set on seeing something right now, you can wait. Generally, the blooms start south and then move north. Mm. So we'll be hitting them probably in the next couple weeks. I haven't seen a ton of stuff in things like Griffith Park yet, although there are some bush sunflowers happening at the Sarah Juan Trailhead in Coral Canyon, which is right off the PCH. Actually, through driving here today through Sepulveda Pass, there were actually some really nice sea notus blooms all along the hills. So if you're stuck on the 405, just look off to the side and enjoy the flowers. And on the southbound 405 on-ramp for the Getty Center, there's actually a really pretty collection of lupins and poppies that's right there.
So you just pull off and...
And be safe. Yeah. Although usually cars aren't moving around there anyway, so you'll probably be okay.
Okay, so how often is a super bloom happening? How rare is this event?
The super blooms are pretty rare. They don't happen very often, although with climate change, sort of changing the weather patterns, we don't really know how often they're going to be. But it usually takes a ton of rain during the winter, which is when we usually get it. But also, it's a variety of conditions that need to happen. So poppies in particular are very finicky plants. Last year, there was a predicted super bloom at the Antelope Valley Poppy Reserve, and then everything was looking good until about 3 days before they were supposed to pop. We got a 3-day heat wave, and it nuked all the flowers. So there's a huge variety of things that can happen, you know, good and bad. So definitely before you're planning on, you know, driving 2 hours out into the desert to see some flowers, make sure you check some of these resources. We've got on modernhiker.com, we've got a great resource page of places that report on weekly, sometimes daily, things that will help you ID the plants that you're seeing, and even things that will help you grow the plants if you want to start planting them in your garden for next year.
Oh, but don't pick them out there.
Please do not pick the flowers. Everything in state parks, everything in federal land is protected. Look, don't touch.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in today.
Of course.
I'm super excited for the super bloom.
And you should be.
Okay. Casey Schreiner, founder and editor of Modern Hiker. And that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.